from KMXT in Kodiak. This is the Alaska Fisheries Report. I'm Jay Barrett. Coming up this week, a dive fisherman dies off the coast of Kodiak. The Opelio tack is down, way down. And how Filipinos came to play such a large role in our seafood industry. All coming up on the Alaska Fisheries Report.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is supported, in part, by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Before we get going this week, we have a clarification. In my story last week about the Togiak herring forecast, it turns out I was comparing apples and oranges instead of, fish. When I said Fish and Game was predicting 66,000 fewer tons of herring to show up, I was comparing the estimated observed spawning biomass from this year with the forecast biomass for next year. Here's the apples-to-apples clarification with figures courtesy of Dillingham Management biologist Tim Sands. The forecast biomass for 2016 is 162,244 tons, which is just 1,236 tons less than the forecast biomass from this year. In other words, not as much difference as we said last week, and still very close to the 10-year average. A fisherman is dead after a diving accident near Kodiak Island on Sunday morning. 36-year-old Gary Graves was a crew member aboard the fishing vessel Momo and Maddie. The accident occurred when he was diving for sea cucumbers about 3 miles off of Sitkalitik Island. Officials say Graves was in about 40 feet of water when his compressor failed or shut off. Coast Guard Petty Officer Trevor Fromhers, watchstander at the command center in Juneau, says they dispatched an MH-60 helicopter from Air Station Kodiak and a rescue swimmer was lowered to the Momo and Maddie. After more than 30 minutes of CPR and consultation with the flight surgeon, Graves was declared dead.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by Alaska Boats and Permits, marine broker for vessels, permits, and IFQs. 1-800-992-4960 or online at alaskaboat.com.
Last week, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game announced catch limits for the state's crab fisheries. On Monday, a fish and game biologist explained how the agency determined those catch limits to a group of crabbers in Seattle. KUCB's Greta Mart has more.
Nine local crabbers gathered at Unalaska's City Hall to tune into the conference call and ask questions. The biggest drop in total allowable catch, or the TAC, is for Bering Sea snow crab. Snow crab is also known as Opelio. The total allowable catch this season for snow crab is just under 40 million pounds. That's a 40% drop from last season. Here's Dutch Harbor crabber Casey McManus.
I think a drop that large was a little bit of a surprise. I think everybody thought the management system for the Opelio fishery was a little bit more on track than that. But it dropped, and hopefully it'll rebound. Hopefully it was just a weird year as far as the survey is considered.
Managers use lots of different measures to figure out how big the catch can be. Fish and Game biologist Doug Pengilly says this year's data from a trawl survey showed a decline in all measures of the snow crab stock. Measures like mature male biomass and the number of juvenile crabs. Pengilly says he and his colleagues started having concerns about the model they were using.
This year the model really seemed to be diverging from all the other trends that we saw.
Pengilly says the agency set last year's catch based on a measure known as area swept estimates. That was the first time they did that since 2006. This year, biologists decided not to rely solely on one measure.
We set the tack using basically a combination of the model estimate and the area swept estimate, which is the estimate that comes right out of the survey data without having a multi-year model put in for it.
Here's crabber Casey McManus again.
We need to understand how they got to the numbers that they did and the science behind it. And if there's some things that are affecting the science that we're doing wrong, we can try to change that and we can learn from it so we can have a sustainable fishery in the future.
The catch limit for this season for Bering Sea Red King crab is just under 10 million pounds, roughly the same as last year. During the conference call, Pengilly said the stocks of Pribilof Blue and Red King crabs are so low that those stocks will not be open to commercial fishing in the foreseeable future.
Reporting in Unalaska, I'm Greta Mart.
You're listening to the Alaska Fisheries Report. Hear the whole show online anytime at kmxt.org.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, working to raise the value of our seafood harvest for the benefit of all Alaskans. On the web at alaskaseafood.org.
The Alaska Historical Society has launched a new initiative to document Alaska's historic canneries. The project is spearheaded by Angelique Grantham, the curator of exhibits at Kodiak's Baranof Museum. She'll be regularly sharing her findings over the next year with us on the Alaska Fisheries Report starting this week, with this piece on how Filipinos came to play such a large role in Alaska's seafood industry.
Alaskeros, or Filipino cannery workers, have been a mainstay of the seafood industry in Alaska for well over a century. October is Filipino-American History Month, and here Christine Marasigan of the Filipino-American National Historical Society tells us of the early beginning of this long-lasting connection.
While there is a history of Filipinos being in America prior to the 1900s, the first instance of Americans being in the Philippines is actually 1898, when you want to talk about a sort of a governmental-to-governmental relationship.
Marasigan is referring to the Spanish-American War, wherein the U.S. defeated Spain and laid claim to former Spanish colonies like Puerto Rico and the Philippines. Marasigan here describes the status of the Philippines following the Spanish-American War.
While it has its own governing agency, it's not really technically independent. It's basically a protectorate of the United States. Basically, if you're a citizen of the Philippines, you're an American national, so you don't need a passport to travel to the United States. And this ends up being a boon for places like Alaska and Hawaii that need a labor pool.
These Filipinos were U.S. nationals, not citizens, and while they couldn't vote or own property, they could work in the U.S. As a result, young Filipinos were recruited in ports like San Francisco for work in Alaska canneries. By the 1930s, Filipinos outnumbered Chinese and Japanese workers to become the largest contingent of cannery laborers.
You know, between the cannery and the military and communications and, you know, early mariners, I mean, I think Alaska figures very significantly in the sort of narrative of the Filipino experience in the Americas.
This is Angelique Grantham with the Alaska Historical Society's Alaska Historic Canneries Initiative, reporting from KMXT in Kodiak.
We'll be hearing from Angelique regularly as she continues the Historic Canneries Initiative.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by the Alaska Marine Safety Education Association, providing U.S. Coast Guard accepted hands-on safety training for all of Alaska's fishermen and their family. AMSEA at amsea.org or 907-747-3287.
In a 346-page report last week, the Cohen Group called into question the fairness of the EPA's proposal to block development of the Pebble Mine at the headwaters of the Bristol Bay Salmon Spawning Grounds. The Cohen Group, led by former U.S. Senator and Defense Secretary William Cohen, was hired by Pebble last spring to conduct the review. KDLG's Dave Benninger tells us more.
In a press call Tuesday morning, Secretary Cohen summed up on several occasions what a 346-page report with his name on it has to say.
My only very narrow ruling in the sense, or judgment in the sense, is that it was unfair to use 404C on a peremptory basis, and it was unfair to use it using hypotheticals.
404C is the section of the Clean Water Act that EPA says gives the agency authority to block Pebble before the company has applied for permits. The hypotheticals Cohen referred to are the mine scenarios EPA used in its Bristol Bay watershed assessment, which was the basis for preemptive restrictions the agency has proposed. Cohen's group was commissioned to take an independent review of EPA's involvement, a study that Pebble paid for. Pebble has long accused the EPA of stepping out of bounds and attempting to cheat the developer out of the standard permitting process mapped out in the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA. Pebble hoped Cohen would agree and lend his voice and reputation to that allegation, which he did.
Given the magnitude of the issues involved, it seems to me it would have been certainly wiser, but I think ultimately much fairer to the state of Alaska and to Pebble to follow the normal procedure.
The response to Cohen's report from Pebble's opponents Tuesday was as swift as it was predictable.
this report was completely bought and paid for by the Pebble Limited Partnership.
That's Alana Hurley with United Tribes of Bristol Bay. In the back and forth over Pebble, neither side's science or studies or reviews ever seemed to pass muster with the opposition. UTBB and a host of other Pebble opponents claim the Cohen report is a smear tactic against the EPA's efforts, which are largely supported in Bristol Bay. Hurley says the report is a distraction from the larger central issue.
Like the lawsuit, this report speaks in no way, shape, or form to the fact that the science is very clear on this, and there's still no question in our minds that this type of mining can't coexist with salmon in Bristol Bay.
But that's not what the Cohen Group says their report was tasked to weigh in on.
This is not about the Pebble Mine.
That's retired Air Force General Joseph Ralston, a former vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who is now a vice chairman of the Cohen Group.
I understand there may be people in Bristol Bay who have strong feelings about this, but this report does not say that Pebble Mine should or shouldn't be built, but this is about fairness of a federal agency.
That's a point Secretary Cohen reiterated during his press conference Tuesday.
It's a rule of law. The rules are established for people to follow. And if the rules are in any way compromised or shortcutted, then it raises questions about the legitimacy of the action taken.
And that legitimacy, or rather the future of the EPA's actions thus far to protect Bristol Bay, has Pebble's opponents concerned. Separate from the Cohen report, the EPA's own inspector general is currently investigating the agency's involvement in Bristol Bay, and one of three lawsuits has found some traction in federal court. EPA lawyers have kept the agency near silent on the matter for months, and on Tuesday, EPA offered only a mild rebuttal to Cohen's report. A spokesperson emailed to say EPA stands behind their three-year effort to study the watershed and proposed use of 404C restrictions they say would protect the fishery. Meanwhile, the clock is ticking on the enviro-friendly Obama administration's time in office. What's next for the Cohen report is unclear. It might soon become just an expensive footnote in the ongoing battle for public perception like the Keystone panel hearings of 2013. But Cohen himself says he saw a number of troubling aspects with EPA's behind-the-scenes actions dating back nearly a decade that need further review, perhaps in courts or Congress.
These are big issues, and when you're dealing with big issues, deal with it in a way that's the most open, so that everybody has a chance to have their say on the record and put it to an examination, a critical examination, and say, okay, under the circumstances, we decide this can't go forward, etc.
Neither Pebble nor the Cohen Group would disclose the cost of the review. Two more things to keep in mind. One, EPA's preemptive restrictions against Pebble are still only proposed at this point and will remain that way likely through the end of the most recent federal lawsuit. And two, Pebble is still without an investment partner to move the project forward and seems a long ways off from requesting to enter the permitting process they say they deserve the chance at. In other words, this fight is far from over. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you by Commercial Fishermen for Bristol Bay, permit holders and fishing groups standing together to protect and enhance the renewable fishing jobs and businesses of the Bristol Bay region.
And that's all for this week's Alaska Fisheries Report. We had help from KTOO's Matt Miller in Juneau, KUCB's Greta Mart in Unalaska, Fish Radio's Lainey Welch in Kodiak, KDLG's Dave Benninger in Dillingham, and guest contributor Angelique Grantham. From KMXT, I'm Jay Barrett in Kodiak.